Good evening, brothers, sisters, young people, and a warm hello to those online. Thank you all for coming out tonight to our Wednesday night class. Today we have Brother Dave. I believe it's the third in his series, and we'll be listening to David and the Ark. To introduce Brother Dave's talk, we don't have a reading, as apparently we'll be going through a lot of chapters. So without further ado.
Well, thanks, Sean, and good evening, everybody, again, on a bit of a winter's night. It's great to be with you here in this warm hall. What we're going to look at tonight is some of the decisions that David made very early in his kingship. And we'll really be taking away the primary lesson that what we prioritize in life really gives a pretty clear indication of what we value, what we prioritize. Really shows or demonstrates to ourselves and perhaps to others what we value. So that's probably one of the big takeaways. And we're going to look, of course, a little bit at praise and worship in the context of David and the Ark. But for those who are here in last class, we finished with David's lament for Saul and Jonathan, which was in the chapter 2 Samuel chapter 1. So we're going to start in 2 Samuel chapter 2. So the king is dead, and long live the king, the new king. So we start in 2 Samuel 2, verse 1. So does David, we talked last class, does he take things into his own hands? Saul's dead. My right is now here. No, he doesn't. We saw that one of his signature moves is to take everything to God in prayer, and that's right up the front, 2 Samuel 2, verse 1. He doesn't presume anything. He goes to God in prayer. David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And we see that the Lord said to him, "Go up." And David said, "Well, to which shall I go up?" And God said, "To Hebron." So with God's blessing, David goes up there. And the men of Judah anoint him king over the house of Judah. And we'll see a little bit later that at this point, David, remarkably, is only 30. Who's the closest to 30 here? Joel, probably you. Not aging you, but Ollie said, "Oh, Seb, how old are you, mate?"
A bit over.
So we're talking a very young man, only 30, and so much has happened already in David's life. So he's the king of Judah. What's his first act as king? Again, what does he prioritize? Well, let's have a look, verse 4. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David says to them some really amazing words, "May you be blessed by the Lord." This is in relation to the man who hunted him mercilessly all over the land. "May you be blessed by the Lord." Why? "Because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord. Now may the Lord show steadfast love," or loyal love, "and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you too, because you have done this thing." So again, what we reward and celebrate shows what we value too. And here I think these men of Jabesh-Gilead remind David of the extraordinary loyalty of Jonathan. Jonathan was, as we saw in one of our earlier classes, so loyal to his father Saul despite all of Saul's inadequacies. And here David admires that same loyal love. It's the Hebrew kesed. Many modern translations say steadfast love. My favourite is loyal love, because that's what it is, a real loyalty despite the inadequacies of the recipient of that love. So David admires this. And then verse 8, it's not all smooth sailing. Very, very quickly the political manoeuvring comes in, which is always the way with a new king, a new CEO, whatever it happens to be, there's always a little bit of political manoeuvring. And verse 8, Abner, he decides, "Well, I'm going to take Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul," and then verse 9, "make him king over Israel. So David's king in Judah, and Abner sets up Ish-bosheth as king over Israel. And the result, if we turn across to chapter 3, verse 1, the result of this is that there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But we read there that the house of David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Now, this is a study on the life of David, so we can't do an in-depth study on the characters like Abner and Joab, but we know that both were incredibly ambitious, powerful, strong, but very politically motivated individuals. So as soon as Abner saw that the flow was going against the house of Saul, what does he do? Verse 12, he approaches David to make a league with him. Look at this, verse 12, make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all of Israel to you. Such a conniving individual. Verse 20, Abner then comes with 20 men to David at Hebron, and interestingly, David makes a feast for Abner and the men with him. And then verse 21, he sends him away in peace. But then very ominously, we get the other big weapon of the time, Joab. Have a look at this. Verse 22, just then, it's quite dramatic, isn't it? Just then, the servants of David arrive with Joab. And we know that Abner had killed Joab's brother. And so this is quite poignant. Verse 23, it's told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king and he's let him go in peace. This was a real shock. And so Joab went to the king and said to him, what have you done? This is extraordinary. And we know that David obviously was someone, as we said, he's a man after God's own heart. How does Psalm 103 define the heart of God? Someone who doesn't deal with us according to our trespasses or our iniquities, or deal with us according to our sin. And so David here didn't judge Abner. He, in fact, treated him very, very well. But that was not to the liking of Joab at all. There wasn't room enough for those two big egos, those two incredibly ambitious, politically motivated people. So Joab does something quite treacherous. Verse 26, Joab sent messages after Abner. They brought him back. Verse 27, maybe for the first time in his life, Abner wasn't as calculating, and he comes back. Abner returned, and Joab then took him aside into the midst of the gate to whisper a private word in his ear, and then whips out his sword and thrusts him right through. It's quite, as I say, treacherous, and it says there, he struck him in the stomach, so he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So this is a real contrast. In this drama, we have David, we looked at last class, repeatedly didn't take matters into his own hands. So as many times he could have executed Saul, he doesn't. He waited on God. With the sons of Zeruiah, Joab was one of them, it was the opposite. Vengeance is mine, I will repay. They didn't hold back at all. They took matters into their hands. They were, as we might say, quite Machiavellian. If you remember Machiavelli, an Italian, I guess sort of we would call like a priest or a prince or one of the royalty, he was famous for that expression, the end justifies the means. And that's what it was like with the sons of Zeruiah. They took things into their own hands. And again, it's interesting here, a brand new king, brand new leader. How does he respond? For some of you might remember, he actually worked extensively with my firm, David Morrison, the Lieutenant General of Australia. He made that famous statement, the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. And he was trying to say that if we just ignore poor behaviour, you're effectively accepting it. So does David accept as a new leader? What's he going to project? Does he accept this poor behaviour? No, he doesn't. It's quite remarkable. He could have seen, well, this is really opening up the way to leadership in Israel with Abner out the way. But verse 31, David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the coffin. Verse 32, the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. This was a person who was opposed to him, who was at war with him. Verse 33, the king lamented for Abner. Verse 35, all the people came to try to persuade David to eat bread while it was daytime, but David swore, saying, God, do so to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And look at this. This is a real important message. All the people took notice of it. Anytime we accept any new role in any respect, people watch the early decisions we make in every single aspect of our life. The people notice this, and how did they react? It says it pleased them. It pleased them because they were amazed by this grace shown to one who arguably didn't deserve it. I mean, think of it. In this very chapter, Abner slept with Saul's concubine as a deliberate act of betrayal and treachery of the very king, Ishbosheth, that he had put on the throne. This is not a nice man. The point is, why was David a man after God's own heart? Because he showed grace. He treated people as they didn't deserve, which is exactly what God does. We saw that last class. He makes the rain to come on the just and the unjust. And David lived that. And he says in verse 38, he says, the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day? This is Abner. And he says, and I was gentle today, though anointed king. He knew he was sending a message. Yes, I'm the king, but I was gentle. The Hebrew means tender-hearted. David was tough. He slew his 10,000s. To be tender-hearted is not weakness. It's not soft. And I think still today we sometimes see people who are more hard on others and take a harder line. We often impute that they must be very righteous because they're really taking a tough position on this. And yet often it's people like Jesus and David and God himself that are more tender-hearted. So let's never confuse softness with weakness or this sense of liberality as if perhaps they're not as serious about the truth as we might call it. David was tender-hearted. That's why he was a man after God's own heart. Quite an amazing example. Now, what happens to Ishbosheth? Well, Abner's out of the way. How long do you think he lasted? Not very long. Kimmy and Lizzie and I were chatting after last class that we might not feel it, but I don't know if anyone's read the book Sapiens. It's quite a read. It's long. It's an amazing book. It's sort of like a book of the history of the world. And one of the observations in there that probably is the biggest takeaway almost from that book, it's amazing how you can summarise an extraordinary book in one sentence, but one of the big takeaways is the observation is we have never lived in a safer epoch or time in history as today. You know, back in the day, if a male lived beyond 30 or 40, you were ancient. And here there's a lot of sort of killing that goes on, and Ishbosheth, he doesn't last too long because two of his captains knock him off in, again, an act of treachery and betrayal. And how does David respond to that? This is the very next incident. Does he see this as, okay, well, now that's paving the way to what I was promised, kingship in Israel? How does he react to that? Well, 2 Samuel 4 verse 5 gives us the answer, because we see there two of Ishbosheth's captains set out in the heat of the day. They come to the house of Ishbosheth. The poor fellow's taking a nap in the middle of the day, his noonday rest, as it says in the ESV. And it then says they came into the midst of the house, making out they were grabbing some wheat, and they went in and stabbed him in the stomach. It's almost like the Caesars and of Rome back in this time. And verse 7, they end up being a little bit more sort of, to us, grotesque probably. They then behead him. And then verse 8, they drag his head to David. So there's a pretty brutal time, right? We don't seem to see that, certainly not in Western society. Sadly, some of this still does exist in the world, but they go in with this head as if they've done David a great favour, right? They, like Abner, they're trying to endear themselves to the new king. And this is what happens in political life, in business life. People try and do these deeds to ingratiate themselves to a new leader. Again, how we respond says what we value. How does David respond here? And again, just note, remember last class we said we should never spiritualize to legitimize. Lots of times around David, people invoke God, like when Saul was in the cave, God's done this, David, so kill him. Or Abishai, this is the work of God, let me kill him. They spiritualize to legitimize. Something that happens today, we weaponize verses of scripture to justify action that scripture was never designed for. And here, these treacherous captains do it again. Verse 8, here is the head of Ishbosheth. The Lord has avenged my lord the king. Really? This day on Saul and his offspring. David has none of it. Verse 10, he refers back to the young Amalekite. Remember the Amalekite said something similar? And David basically saw him asunder, cut him in half, as he was so upset with him. And this is what David says, verse 10, to these treacherous captains. He said, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, I killed him. How much more, verse 11, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed. He's saying Ishbosheth was totally innocent. He was in his own house, lying there, having a rest, and you treacherously betrayed him and killed him. Shall I not now require his blood at your hand? So David could see straight through to their naked ambition, and he has none of it. The end never justified the means. He saw straight through this attempt to spiritualize it. The Lord has avenged. He didn't take matters into his own hands, and he didn't like it when others tried to do that, even if it was for his own ultimate gain. He didn't want to be complicit in any of that sort of behavior. Anyway, it didn't stop the people. Chapter 5, verse 3. We read, so all the elders of Israel ultimately came to King David at Hebron, and they anointed him king over Israel. So by this time, David's now 37. So he had reigned as king of Judah for 7 years, from 30 to 37. And then we know that he was king of both Israel and Judah for 33 years. So still a pretty young man. At 37 to be king of Judah and Israel. So after establishing himself in Jerusalem as the new capital, which is a study in itself as to why he wanted to be there, but we'll leave that to another, to one side. After that, what do we think happens? Well, if you're an enemy, what would you want to do? You'd want to make an early strike, a preemptive strike. So you get all the internal politics, but an external enemy, what would you do? You would strike early. And that's exactly what the Philistines do. Verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines, all of them came together. Verse 18, and they spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So what does David do? His signature move. He goes straight to God in prayer. He doesn't feel some ego boost. I'm now the king of Israel and Judah. It's my ordained right. I'm here to make decisions, so I'll make decisions. No, he goes straight to God. Have a look at it. Verse 19, David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said, go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand. So a real man of prayer. He didn't neglect that now that he was the king. So the Philistines are roundly defeated, but they're not deterred. They regroup and they come again. So does David think, well, clearly God's with me. Look what happened last time. It was a sound defeat. I'll just go out again, expect the same, presume the same. Not at all. Again, he goes back to God. So verse 22, the Philistines came up yet again and again spread out in the valley of Rephaim. Verse 23, when David again inquired of the Lord, he said, God said on this occasion, actually, I don't want you to go up. So imagine if he had. It wouldn't have been according to the will or advice of God, because God, this is the time when God gives him that quite interesting sort of military strategy. He says, you shall not go up. Go around to the rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. When you hear the sound of the wind in the trees, in the tops of the balsam trees, rouse yourself, for only then is the Lord with you to go out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines. David did as the Lord commanded and struck them from Geba to Gezer. So again, we can see how repeatedly, early in his kingship, David really commits to a leadership with God, taking God with him in every decision, every step. It's wonderful to see and is a real lesson to us. Remember, last class, we shared that concept that there's sort of a maturity that I must confess in my life is something really that I've probably been practicing as best I can really in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, where it's not just about identifying a challenge, it's not just about taking it to God in prayer faithfully, it's the next step, which we learn from David, which we won't go over last class. I'm sure it was recorded. But what we then said in the life of David, which is nuanced, it might sound obvious, but it's nuanced and it takes real discipline and belief and true faith to practice. What David did after he prayed was he stepped forward in faith, believing that God was directing his steps. And he talks about that multiple times in the Psalms and Proverbs. So can you see how that's actually a graduation? That to believe that my steps are ordered by the Lord, but to step forward believing that that guidance, and then, which is the ultimate act of faith, having confidence, not continuing to worry, to have to rest that God's got us, God's guiding us. So the prayer bit is one thing, stepping forward in faith, believing our steps are guided by God, and then resting in that. That's amazing. David was like that. It's almost a lovely form of almost in today's modern world naivety, if you might say that, not disrespectfully, but I think it's almost that's why Jesus called it a childlike faith. A child takes the hand of dad or mum, in full belief that where dad and mum are going is the right place. And they rest in that. And that's how David did it. It's quite amazing. All right. So, new king, all the political internal maneuverings, the external has assaulted. These are things that he couldn't control. What's his then next recorded move? One of his earliest moves as the king of Israel and Judah. What's his priority? That move as a brand new king of Israel. Yes, obviously he had to deal with the Philistines, but then what?
The Ark.
Says so much, doesn't it? Everything about David can be summed up in that prioritization. Why? Because we know the Ark, the mercy seat, was the meeting place between God and the people. This is David. He's such a beautiful character. He's earthy. He wants to feel God close. And it was real to him. We'll see that David goes and sits and chats to God. He wanted God, his friend almost, to be with him. And he's like, I don't want to be sitting here in a cedar paddled throne room in Jerusalem whilst the ark's in a tent. And so chapter 6, verse 2, David arose and went with all the people from Baal Judah to bring up the ark of God. That was his big priority. And verse 5, we read, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets. I like that. A bit of Spanish in thrown in. And cymbals. Now, to state probably, hopefully, for what all of you hear is the obvious, but has been misabused countless times within our community. I read lots of previous Christadelphian talks, listened to a number of old tape recordings. You would almost think that the error on this day and the reason Uzzah lost his life was because of this like terrible worldly celebration and music and dancing. Because for some reason that became the topic of quite a lot of the talks. Nothing could be further from the truth. Have you ever noticed that the celebration and the use of all these musical instruments is actually just as big, or when you really look into it, bigger in the second? That was not the issue. It's not a crime, and it wasn't the crime, but even today, it's so humorous, isn't it? In 2026, that if you went to one of our churches or ecclesias and all of a sudden there was this, cymbals, like, you know, wow, whoa, that speaks drum kit, castanets or tambourines, bang, guitars, which is really harps, lyres, and songs, there would be many still in our community, whoa, this is really bad, like this is way too liberal. I don't feel good about this, and it's not just because I'm a conservative Anglophile. I would be freaking out. Yes, you wanted to say something.
Quite normal for Nepalese.
Correct. I was going to say that thank God that some of us do have the ability to, you know, there's more Christadelphians in black Africa. So there's more of us that are black than white in our Christadelphian community who do embrace music, because music, we were chatting over dinner about it, is something that engages the mind and the heart. And there's actually a lot of us. We had a great chat recently amongst friends at Burnside. When do you feel closest to God was the little question we were chatting about. And like for me, as an aside, for me that's out in nature. For me that would be on my own, on a mountain, particularly if there's a bit of snow or something, or in a forest, or on the water, Kerry, you know, or Timmy. That's when I feel closest to God. But it was interesting. Good friend, Elizabeth Robson, who many of you know, she said, without a doubt, it's when I'm with a whole bunch of people when we're singing and worshipping and praising God, I feel closest to God. So this is actually super important, because for some it's the peak spirituality. One of our young girls at Burnside, the reason she decided to get baptized, the clincher, in fact, she went to a Hebron, came home, said, I wanted to get baptized, and the next Sunday she was baptized. That's Evan Kate Franco's eldest daughter was because of the song and praise. It just was like, this is it. And so here we've got to, I think, ponder sometimes how, and nothing from tonight, I'm not making a point of tonight, but to some extent our worship and praise sometimes is frankly very sedate, sedentary almost, moribund in fact. For some of us as young people, if you sing from the Green Hymn Book about terrestrial balls and things, we actually don't even have a clue what we're talking about. And at some times when the little pace symbol up the top left, is it M, that talks about how fast a hymn should be sung, you go to some ecclesias or churches in our community and it is like a funeral march. This is not this. This was an extraordinary, passionate celebration before the Lord. And so I think we've just got to, yes, I'm probably like many of you, I have two left feet. I do love to dance, but not necessarily brilliant at it. But all of our funny little inhibitions are just that. There's lots of dancing in the Bible. There's lots of incredible use of musical instruments. There is nothing, zero, inherently, intrinsically wrong about it at all, period. It is purely our inhibition and our upbringing and our cultural context. So why then was Uzzah struck dead? Because I suspect for a lot of us we think, whoa, that what was the real issue then? Because it wasn't the music. The music was just as big and vibrant and loud and joyful in the second bringing of the ark. Don't turn to it, but if you're taking notes or you want to put a note in your margin, you get the very clear answer because it's not in Samuel, but in Chronicles it's there. 1 Chronicles 13 verse 4, it says, all the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. It's the exact same expression you find in the Judges. So basically they had pure motivation, totally sincere, and they said, well, this we'll do it this way. We'll get the ox, we'll put it on a cart, we'll bring it up, we'll celebrate, it's awesome. And yep, this is great. It's great. And it was right in their eyes. The problem was that it wasn't right. It was right in their eyes, but it wasn't right. Certainly not the way God wanted it to be. And it was a really big, rude awakening for David very early as the king of Judah and Israel. This went horribly, horribly wrong, pear-shaped in the extreme. It arrested David like there was no tomorrow. Boom, stopped in his tracks. Verse 8, how was David? He's not a pop-up picture in a kiddie's book. He's a real person, and he was angry. Verse 8, David was angry because the Lord had broken out. He saw this as God breaking out against Uzzah. And verse 9, David was afraid of the Lord and said, how can the ark ever come to me? How can this happen? So he's angry, he's confused, he's afraid. So what does he do? For 3 months, verse 10, he wasn't willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David. He left it with Obed-Edom. For all that time, he's angry, he's afraid, he's confused. What was so pure in terms of the motivation? Every being, everything he desired was for that ark, the presence of God to be with him, and it went horribly wrong. Until someone says, hey, David, did you know that the house of Obed-Edom has been super blessed by, and we think it's because the ark is in there. And so David takes that as a sign that God's good now with him. That's how he sort of interprets it. Verse 12, it was told the king, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark. And so taking that as a sign, verse 12, David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David, again with rejoicing. Now, The challenge again is that in the Samuel record, you really can't tell much difference between 1 and 2. Again, you have to go to Chronicles to see the difference because it's quite profound. So let me read it to you if you're taking notes. 1 Corinthians 15 verse 2, because there it says, David said, this is the difference. He said, David said that no one but the Levites may carry the ark of God. Why? For the Lord has chosen them to carry the ark of the Lord. Verse 11, David summoned the priests and he said to them, you are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites. Consecrate yourselves. This is all different. Consecrate yourselves, prepare you and your brothers so that you may bring up the ark of the Lord. Because, look at this, because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us. He had studied this. He went away and studied it and he worked out why it happened. He then says, because we did not seek him according to the rule. We did it our way. What was right in our eyes. And then we read, so the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord. The Levites carried the ark of the Lord on their shoulders with the poles. And look at this, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. So this time he does it all properly. And by doing it properly, there was no music, just the green hymn book. That's proper. Not at all. The music, the joy, the celebration was there, bigger and better. But it also, and this is super important too, it also was according to what God wanted. And what God wanted didn't preclude any of that extraordinary celebration. But there is a lesson, probably mostly for us young people. It's not just cool if it feels good. It's not just cool if we think it's great. There's got to be respect. There's got to be respect for God and for our Lord Jesus when it comes for worship. There's got to be respect for how Jesus asked us to remember him. There is guidance on how we should remember Jesus. By the way, a lot of what we do has nothing to do with what the Bible says, but some of it is key, like we take of the emblems. That is in the Bible. So we must adhere, as David learnt, to what God requires of us. But it's certainly the celebration, the pageantry was not the crime. Look at it this time now. It's still verse 16 of Chronicles. So I'll be continuing to read there. You listen to it. David commanded the chiefs of the Levites to appoint their brothers as the singers who should play loudly on musical instruments, on harps and lyres and cymbals to raise sounds of joy. Verse 25, so David went to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the house of Obed-Edom with rejoicing. David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, as also were all the Levites who were carrying the ark, and the singers, and Chenaiah, the leader of the music of the singers. And then we read, and David wore a linen ephod. So all Israel brought up the ark of the covenant of the Lord with shouting. Look at that, with shouting to the sound of the horn, trumpets, cymbals, and made loud music on harps and lyres. So I hope in my lifetime I'll probably be so old, grey and decrepit to enter into it, but I sincerely hope in my lifetime that we get to that sort of level of praise and worship and we embrace more musical instruments that engage the heart and the mind in our praise. And maybe we even get to the point of actually dancing before the Lord and really celebrating. Anyone who's danced like David danced, it's one of the funnest things you can do in your life. And to do that in a spiritual way and to lose those inhibitions and just be overcome with a joy of celebrating out of grace, appreciation to God and Jesus, that would be a beautiful thing done in the right way, in the right way. So David, let's look at David. He is so euphoric. In his ecstasy, he danced before the Lord with the Hebrew, was probably best translated, with every fibre of his being, from one of our songs. The modern expression, he danced like no one was watching. He absolutely went for it. In fact, it was perhaps, if you look at the timing, it would have been quite warm, so he actually strips down. He strips down to just his ephod because he's going for it. He's absolutely dancing with abandon before God, and that's the important thing, before the Lord. And the issue, there was no issue whatsoever in any of that with David. In fact, the issue was with Michael, whose reaction to that is decidedly like it would be today if any of us did that today. And the problem was with her, because for her it was all about keeping up appearances. David, you're the new king of Israel and Judah. You are an embarrassment. You're embarrassing yourself. And she did what we would all do. She imputed the worst motive to him. She actually imputes something quite horrific. She says, basically, you were indecently exposing yourself before all the young women. I know what you were doing, David, is effectively what she says. It's quite terrible. You know, let's make this real. How do you feel if you've been to a Christadelphian church or ecclesia when people do something that's pretty basic, like maybe they sway or clap their hands to the song? And we think, whoa, that's like really bad. I don't think that these people are as serious about the truth as me because they're clapping their hands. Like, it's really quite silly, isn't it? But for many years, those perceptions have existed. Like next time we sung, if we all swayed, or like at your next song and praise, we raise our phones like a lamp, like you might at a concert with it. Whoa. Like, actually, people pray with their hands raised, or like, it's not a crime. It's not a crime. Let's make sure that we don't do a Michael and project our inhibition and insinuate things about others' worship which might be totally sincere. Look at David, verse 20. David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "Oh, how the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before," look what he thought, "before the eyes of his servants, female servants," as in she's saying, your female servants, "as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." She saw all of that. What was David doing? Look back, if you're still in chapter 6, verse 14, this is what David was doing. And David danced, who, before these women, before these, he probably didn't even notice them. He would have been in a whole nother world with God. David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all his house, etc. He danced before the Lord. That was his whole focus. And yet Michael imputed the worst motivation to him that could be done. To her, it was all about what clothes you should be wearing. Like, this is the memorial meeting. What are you doing here with an ephod, is what she's saying. Like, this is inappropriate. It's totally inappropriate. It was all about the clothes, of making the right impression. How does David respond? Oh, yes, Michael, sorry. I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. No, forget that. He actually does a bit like a Paul. Why should my liberty in Christ be judged by you, Michael? Look what he says. It's really quite strong. David said to Michael, it was before the Lord. And guess what? I will do it again. He says, and I will celebrate before the Lord. You ain't going to stop me. I will make myself, look at this, it's quite strong. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this. You watch when I dance next time. I'll be doing backflips, forward flips, you name it. And you ain't going to stop me. And I will be abased in your eyes. It's what God feels. And I want with every fiber of my voice, my body, to express my passion before him. Now, I'm not Middle Eastern, right? We've got to remember David is Middle Eastern, right? More melodramatic, more passionate people, more expressive. If you've ever been to a Middle Eastern funeral, a European funeral, it's more expressive than us, keep calm, carry on, stiff upper lip. If you're not British, that's my background. I couldn't do this, right? It would be unnatural for me. And I'm sure Liz would probably say to Michael, like, that was embarrassing. That's happened a few times. But for David, this was natural. And so, again, let's take the lesson. With praise and worship, it is before the Lord. It does need to be done appropriately. David learnt that. But appropriately doesn't mean no instruments. It doesn't mean moribund, sedentary. It can be incredibly joyful. It can even involve dancing. It done in the right spirit with the right attitude. And let's not be the ones who in our assessment, we don't do jury service, but we're really good judges. I judge that ecclesia. Whew, have you seen what they do? Have you heard the instruments they use? In fact, I heard that they clap their hands. I mean, come on. We got to be better than that. All right. Now, 1 Corinthians 16. David wrote a song for this. He wrote some lyrics, and his lyrics are amazing. We don't have time to go into it, but if you can flip across to 1 Chronicles 16, it's the most amazing song. I'd love to hear in the kingdom him play it, right? David could play this song for us because he wrote this song. It's called The Song of Thanks. And there's some amazing lyrics. Verse 11, seek the Lord and his strength, seek his presence continually. He's telling us that's why I brought the ark. I wanted to feel the presence of God. And so that's an awesome sentiment for us. Let's always want to feel the presence of God. Let's walk by the Spirit. Let's feel the Spirit of God in our lives, and let's take comfort that we want God with us always. That was David's expression here. Verse 28, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. And that really encapsulates a point we made last class. Make God bigger, not smaller. Impute more to the providence of God than less. Even if we get it wrong, thank God that he worked in my life today. Attribute those things to him. Make him part of it. Ascribe it to him. Attribute to him. Even if we're wrong, a spiritual life is seeing God in all aspects of it. And then one that I reckon would be on all of our lips, verse 33 and verse 35. Isn't this how we all feel? Then shall the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. Verse 35, and here's our heart's desire. Save us, O God of our salvation. Gather us and deliver us from among the nations, that we may give thanks to your holy name and glory in your praise. So that's how we all feel today, isn't it? We want that moment. We want that moment desperately to come. It's all of our prayer. So what's his next moment? What does he do next? Go back to 2 Samuel 6. He's brought the ark back. He has the presence of God there. And then, as I said, he's sitting in his house of cedar and saying, why am I in this magnificent palace and we don't have a house for the ark. We really haven't yet constructed anything to house God, as it were, the presence of God. And so 2 Samuel 7 verse 1 says, "Now when the king lived in his house and the Lord had given him rest from all the surrounding enemies, the king said to Nathan, 'See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent.'" So in response to that, we know Nathan's message to David, it's not going to be for you, but then he gives the promise to David, right, in this chapter. We know exactly the promise to David. But what I wanted to bring out from that, which we often don't look at because we look at the promise and how amazing that is, but what did that mean to David? Because we know that the promise in 2 Samuel 7, David interpreted that rightly, that it meant that he would live forever. He says that in Psalm 16, "You will not suffer your Holy One to see corruption." He's writing that as a messianic psalm, but in that psalm he also expresses, he refers to 2 Samuel 7 and says, "That's me." Let me read to you Psalm 16, verse 5. "The Lord is my chosen portion. You hold my lot. The lions have fallen for me in pleasant places. I have a beautiful inheritance," David writes. Verse 9, "My flesh dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption." So David made this very personal, and he writes in that psalm this sense of, I have a lot. He calls it a lot, like we might say a plot. I have a plot of land in the kingdom with my name on it, is how David feels. I know I will die, but this promise means I'll live again to see my greater son. And it overwhelms him. It absolutely overwhelms him. This beautiful man, he's left absolutely speechless at this. And so this is where I want to read to you quite a moment that in David's life isn't covered that often, but it's really beautiful. Verse 18 of 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. It literally says this: "King David went in and sat before the Lord." And look how he talks to God. He says, "Who am I, O Lord God, and what is my house that you have brought me thus far? I'm a king." This is incredible. Verse 9, "You have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come, that my house will endure." Verse 20, he starts speaking in the third person. It's quite cute. He says, "What more can David say to you?" He's talking about himself. "What more can David say to you?" He's just chatting with God. What can I say to you? Verse 21, "According to your own heart, God, you have brought about all this greatness." Verse 22, "You are great, O Lord God." Verse 27, "For you, O Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have made this revelation to your servant, saying, 'I will build you a house.'" And then he says something so amazing. He says, "Because of all of this, therefore your servant has found courage to pray this prayer to you." That's the ESV. "I found courage to pray this prayer to you." You know what the word courage means? It literally means to dig into one's heart. He says, "I'm so overwhelmed, I'm speechless, I've had to dig right within my heart to find the words to express to you, God, how incredibly grateful I am for this amazing promise that you've made to me." It's really beautiful prayer language from David that shows the intimacy of his relationship. Now, just two little things before we close that I thought would be worth wrapping up so that we have the ability in next, if there is a next one, to talk about David and Bathsheba, which is the next class. So 2 Samuel 8 David's then had all the victories over all the surrounding nations, and he's at peace, and he becomes quite wealthy. And I just thought there's a little lesson for us in this. Verse 11, 2 Samuel 8, verse 11. It says there, "And Joram brought with him articles of silver, gold, bronze." Look at this. "These King David dedicated to the Lord. Together with the silver and gold he dedicated from all the nations he subdued." One of the things when you look at the life of David, yes, he was an incredibly wealthy man, but he was incredibly generous in giving to the nation, to the house of the Lord, to the building of the temple. Amazing. And I hope I cause no offence in this statement, but in our community, we don't sort of religiously adhere to tithing, you know, 10%. Many other modern churches still do. Certainly if you look at our collections, we don't. But that's not judgment, because many of us might give in many other ways other than the collection. So it's a very personal thing. But one thing I would say, and maybe just take it away because it's for you deeply yourself, and whenever we talk about money, it's like, be careful. But just a thought. Jesus said, freely give as you have been freely given. And so there's proportionality. And I think it's a really good practice, tithing, 10%, whatever the percentage is. But to actually look at, essentially, at every stage of our life, what do I earn? And as a percentage, what do I give? And how do I feel about that? That's all, because then it's different for every single one of us, because we all earn totally different amounts. But our percentage could be quite similar. And it's just a good little test. All right, the last one. After this, he's now subdued all the nations. What is his final act in this early phase of his reign? What does he do? Well, he remembers the covenant with Jonathan. That's so beautiful, because sometimes it's a very human thing. Once we get to greatness, once we get to be a king, we're no longer Jenny from the Bronx. We forget all the people that were there for us when we were a little person, and we only have time for the VIPs. Yeah, it happens all the time. We forget who we were and who helped us get there. Not with David. 2 Samuel 9, verse 1. "Is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness?" Why? For Jonathan's sake. He remembers. He's such an honourable person. He remembers the covenant he made to Jonathan. Jonathan pled with him, "Show kindness to my house." And so he says, first, "I want to show them kindness for Jonathan's sake." And then verse 3, "that I may show the kindness of God to him." I love that. He's saying, I'm not going to be one of these people who's gracious to heaven for what heaven gives me. I really appreciate all God's forgiveness, but sure as heck, I'm not going to forgive you here on earth. David's saying, God's been so kind to me, I'm going to be kind here on earth. Consistent. And I'm going to do it to the house of Saul in honouring Jonathan. And so this is where he finds Mephibosheth. There's a few Ishibosheths and Mephibosheths. This was the poor young lad who was crippled from 5 years old when he was dropped. And verse 7, he says to him these beautiful words, "I will show you kindness." Why? "For the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul. And even more beautiful, you shall eat at my table." This is the son of Saul, a man who mercilessly hunted his life. He doesn't pay it on to the next generation. So loving, because of his love and his covenant to Jonathan. We'll leave it there. Thanks, Sean.